The headlines. China says it will take resolute and forceful measures over a brief visit by Taiwan's vice president to the U.S. British junior doctors push ahead with the latest round of their highly disruptive strike as the government rejects their pay rise demand. And public anger is mounting over the official response to the wildfires in the U.S. state of Hawaii as the death toll rises to 93. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Taiwan. This is News. Thanks for joining us. China has strongly condemned the U.S. for arranging a visit by the Taiwanese Vice President William Lai. Beijing says it will take resolute and forceful measures to safeguard its national sovereignty and territorial integrity. The Chinese Foreign Ministry says that Beijing is firmly opposed to any form of official exchanges between the U.S. and Taiwan. It also labeled Lai a downright troublemaker. Lai is a vocal separatist and a candidate in Taiwan's presidential elections next year. He's officially making transit stops in the U.S. en route to and from Paraguay. China claims Taiwan as its own territory. Washington does not have formal diplomatic relations with the island, but maintains close ties with the territory and is its most important international source of weapons. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Junior doctors in the UK are on the third day of the latest round of their highly disruptive strike over pay. The industrial action began Friday and will continue until Tuesday. It includes action by doctors just days into the medical practice and could push the total number of appointments canceled due to the NHS strikes past 1 million. The junior doctors are demanding a 35% pay rise. The government says this is unrealistic and not negotiable. Its proposal is a fourth of what junior doctors seek. Rolling strikes by NHS staff since December are estimated to have cost the service nearly $1.3 billion. The number of people on waiting lists for treatment has also surged to a record 7.6 million. Syed Poor is a correspondent joining us from London. Also, Bob Gill is the producer of the Great NHS Heist, who also joins us from London. Welcome to you both. So, Syed, over to you first. I'm guessing that this should be a starter, 35% as opposed to the 6% that Rishi Sunak said is non-negotiable. That was just barely, I think, about 3 weeks ago or a month ago. So where do things stand, really, when it comes to these doctors who are on strike?
Yeah, that offer from the government came after the pay review body suggested that amount, as well as more than £1,200 of one-off pay to wages, hoping that they could put this to rest. But it hasn't happened. And yes, as far as things stand, it is a deadlock. There doesn't seem to be any progress, although we understand that there might be informal negotiations going on between the two sides. The government, as you say, said, look, that's our final offer. We're not going to come to the negotiating table. And the junior doctors, the unions are saying, as long as there's no parity, that there's no pay restoration, they're not returning to the negotiating table either. So hence the situation we're in now. But as to how we got in here, of course, the strikes come hot on the heels of that number that you read earlier of the NHS waiting list going past 7.5 million. Although the doctor would like, the government would like to say that this is the result of the strike action that's been going on since December last year, when the junior doctors first walked out their job off their jobs. The unions are saying, look at the numbers since 2010. In 2010, the numbers were at 2.5 million. By right before the pandemic, it was at 5 million, and right before they took industrial action, it was already at 7 million. While they're saying while the strikes are having an impact, there are other more fundamental issues that are affecting and plaguing the NHS, the National Health Service. One important reason is staffing, recruiting and retaining the staff in the NHS, and not just junior doctors, it's the nurses and all the other people who work for this fabled National Health Service, or what is left of it. I'm sure Dr. Gill will have a lot to say about that. You're looking at doctors who are leaving the profession in their droves. They are going all the way to places such as Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and elsewhere where conditions and pay wages are higher. Some of them are saying, look, try and walk in our shoes. You are a doctor. You are dealing with life and death situations, telling people when they're going to die, things like that. You and then you have to worry about your rent or your bills. You shouldn't have to do that. And they're saying, if the Secretary of Health believes that we are worth nearly 20 pounds an hour, then we're going to call this off. But that is not happening. And the government has really dug in as far as its position is concerned, saying it's not happening. Uh-huh. And we're not going to do that 35% you're asking for.
Did you say 20 pounds an hour, Saeed?
Nearly 20 pounds an hour.
Right. All right.
Right now, as it stands, they're making less than someone who is working, for example, in PrEP, which is getting paid the minimum wage, is just over 10 pounds an hour.
Okay. So how do we approach this conversation, Bob, taking a look at what's happening? Because as I mentioned to a correspondent there, you know, when you had Rishi Sunak say this is it, you know, I think it was 6% pay raise at the most. My question to you is, I would think that in the case of doctors and nurses in the medical field, there should be an exception where you shouldn't have one-size-fits-all approach when it comes to pay increases, because after all, these people are responsible for people's lives, generally speaking. So I'll start off with that. Don't you think that an exception should have been made?
Yeah, I think it's important to understand the background. Over the past decade, NHS staff have experienced a 25% real terms wage cut. So if your wages have shrunk, in order to restore their value, it has to be increased by 30% plus to get to where you were 10 years ago. So although the figure may sound high, it's purely about restoring the wages. Now, if you don't restore the wages, we've experienced high inflation, cost of living is going through the roof. Year on year, doctors and nurses have got poorer and poorer, and they are struggling to make ends meet. And if you add on top of that the responsibility of the work, this is untenable. So the problem with recruitment and retention is directly linked to the government's deliberate wage suppression policy. Then you might ask yourself, well, why are they doing this? And they're doing it because the NHS is no longer what it used to be. It's been totally repurposed over years of legislation, and now it resembles the American model, which is publicly funded but privately controlled and privately delivered. And these private companies want a very cheap workforce. So they don't want expensive, you know, well-qualified people. In fact, they're replacing doctors with non-doctors. The government is not worried about the waiting list, because the waiting list has been rising before the pandemic and before strike action, but they now have a convenient scapegoat. But government policy is to deliberately drive up waiting lists, to drive down wages, and they've handed control of our healthcare to private companies to extract as much profit as possible.
Thank you, Saeed, for the update there, and thank you, Bob Gill, producer of the Great NHS Heist. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in. The death toll from the Hawaii wildfires has risen to 93 amid growing anger over the response to the deadliest U.S. blaze in 100 years. Hawaiian authorities are saying that the number of fatalities will increase further as hundreds are still unaccounted for. The fire has damaged or destroyed more than 2,200 structures in the hardest-hit town of Lahaina. It also left thousands homeless. Officials have launched an investigation into the handling of the fire, as residents are complaining that there had been no warnings. Hawaii Congresswoman Jill Tokuda says officials had underestimated the danger of the devastating fire. The blaze has been described as the worst natural disaster in the island's history. Iran and the U.S. have announced a deal to unblock Iranian assets frozen in South Korea due to U.S. sanctions. The deal follows indirect talks between Tehran and Washington, and also calls for a prisoner swap between the two sides. According to the Iranian Foreign Ministry, Tehran has received the necessary guarantees from the U.S. side in that regard.
the Iranian Foreign Ministry has announced the start of a process to unfreeze Iran's assets blocked in South Korea due to American sanctions.
The process for releasing several billion dollars of the Islamic Republic of Iran's assets, which had been illegally frozen in South Korea by the United States for several years, has started. Iran has received necessary guarantees that the U.S. will abide by its commitments in this regard.
The ministry said the decision on how to utilize these unfrozen resources lies with the Islamic Republic of Iran, adding that the assets will be used to meet the country's needs. That followed claims that Iran's access to these assets will be limited. Meanwhile, under the deal, a number of Iranians, whom the foreign ministry statement said are held in the U.S. under the false accusations of circumventing sanctions, will be released. The ministry said several American prisoners in Iran, whose freedom was sought by Washington, are still in Tehran. Iran's mission at the United Nations put the number of those prisoners at 5, that they have been released to house arrest in preparation for a prisoner swap between the two countries. And Iran's Vice President for Political Affairs, Mohammad Jamshidi, said the American prisoners will leave the country after Iranian assets are fully transferred to Tehran. It came after reports by U.S. media outlets, including the New York Times and the CNN, quoted sources as saying that Washington will allow the transfer of nearly $6 billion of Iran's assets in South Korea to an account in the Central Bank of Qatar. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has welcomed the prisoner swap, but said the U.S. will keep up sanctions against Iran.
In any event, in any respect, Iran will not be receiving any sanctions relief. And in any instance where we would engage in such efforts to bring Americans home from Iran, Iran's own funds would be used and transferred to restricted accounts such that the monies can only be used for humanitarian purposes, which, as you know, is permitted under our sanctions. There's an exemption for humanitarian that's there from the start.
The Islamic Republic has in the past rejected U.S. claims of sanctions exemptions for humanitarian purposes. Iran says the sanctions are inhumane and illegal and has directly affected its people's life.
The process of releasing Iran's assets in South Korea comes after Iranian funds blocked in Iraq were unfrozen last month. All those are seen as a victory for the administration of President Ebrahim Raisi, who has been pursuing what it calls a dignified diplomacy.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew his country from the 2015 Iran deal in 2018, restoring sanctions on the Islamic Republic. That was part of what Trump called a maximum pressure campaign, which has continued under his successor Joe Biden. Part of the campaign has resulted in business restrictions. But Iranian officials say the so-called pressure campaign has failed as Iran's oil exports has come closer to the figures prior to the reimposition of the sanctions. Statistical data also shows Iran's non-oil exports to the neighboring and friendly states have grown drastically in the past few years. Tehran has time and again blasted the U.S. for what it sees as addiction to sanctions. Based on a report in May 2022, Iran has between $100 and $120 billion trapped in foreign accounts because of the U.S. sanctions. The latest agreements between Tehran and Washington to release several billions of Iran's frozen assets is hailed as another example of an active and dignified diplomacy, policies that the administration of Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, says are on its agenda to protect the rights of the Iranian people in any situation. And the latest deal is significant because it has preserved Iran's dignity as Tehran would not take the first step unless the U.S. shows its commitments under the deal. Also, it is the Islamic Republic that decides for which purposes it uses the unblocked funds, with the foreign ministry saying they would be used to meet the country's needs. The release of Iranian funds in South Korea comes after several billions of dollars of other Iranian assets frozen in Iraq were unblocked in July this year. Iran has time and again said it will continue to safeguard its rights and will never bow to outside pressure.
The chronic financial crisis of the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, is deeply worsening, especially in the second half of 2023. This has created concerns among Palestinian refugees that the UN agency could end all of its services as soon as September. Our Gaza correspondent Ola Alassi has more.
75 years after the forced displacement during the Nakba, Palestinian refugees are concerned about the dire financial crisis facing the UNRWA. Since its establishment in 1949 by the UN General Assembly, UNRWA has dedicated all its effort to help protect the Palestinian refugees by providing humanitarian services and supporting their education. 2023 marks the most dangerous year for over 5 million Palestinian refugees spread across the occupied territories, Jordan, Lebanon, and other countries. Here is where Hatem Mehjez, a Palestinian refugee, father of eight, was born after his father was displaced. He and his family are facing a serious situation because of the shrinking of UNRWA's essential services. Hatem spoke to Press TV about his fears of losing essential services like food assistance, which is the main source for his family. Talking about the shrinking supplies, Hatem is expressing his concerns about the future of his sons, who couldn't afford to marry and have their own families, as they are trying to work hard to support their younger siblings.
My sons can barely find work due to Gaza's disastrous situation amid the prolonged Israeli blockade and the rapidly rising fuel and food prices. They can hardly manage to get cooking gas and electricity. Sometimes on days like today, we don't find food on our table the whole day.
The politicization of the Palestinian refugees' plight jeopardizes the lives of over 1.2 million people in the Gaza Strip. The international community must shoulder their responsibilities towards the Palestinian refugees who were forcibly displaced from their original lands. Palestinian refugees continue to suffer since they were displaced back during the Nakba in 1948 by the Israeli occupation. The current UNRWA's financial crisis is harming thousands of Palestinian refugee families in Gaza whose only hope is not to go hungry. Al-Asif, Gaza.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. In the first part, we saw how in 1951, inhabitants of a French village were suddenly tormented by terrifying hallucinations. At least seven people died, dozens were taken to a local asylum, and hundreds were affected. Immediately, wild theories started emerging to explain this mysterious case of mass insanity. There were claims of poisoned flour, contaminated water, and even witchcraft. The truth was stranger than any of these theories. The Central Intelligence Agency had spiked the local food with LSD as part of a mind control experiment at the height of the Cold War. And with time, U.S. government's interest in LSD shifted from a defensive to an offensive orientation. While the initial experiments with LSD were fairly simple, if shockingly unethical, over time, these LSD experiments grew increasingly elaborate. Stay with us as victims reveal the naked truth in the next part of this program.
Entire populations bore the consequence of large-scale tests. Here are some examples. Again, uncontested cases that are recognized by the American government. In 1953, radioactive iodine was injected into newborns and pregnant women at Iowa University and also in Nebraska. In 1955, the CIA sprayed whooping cough bacteria off the coast of Tampa. Two died, and dozens fell ill. Also in 1955, the CIA enlisted prostitutes in San Francisco, opened two brothels and tested drugs on the clients, then filmed through a one-way mirror. In 1956, the Army released millions of mosquitoes carrying yellow fever and dengue on the towns of Savannah and Avon. There were several deaths and hundreds of people infected. In 1960, in Cincinnati, the Army financed a radiation program on 90 destitute or ill inhabitants of the city's University Hospital. Some died after several weeks. In 1966, the Army tested a virus in the New York Metro, then in Chicago. The bacteria was concealed in electric bulbs. The aim was to study the spread of chemical agents on a large scale. For these experiments, the Army or the CIA funded laboratories in the most prestigious universities: Yale, Stanford, Harvard, or Columbia. They all took part. Glorified by the idea of working for the nation's defense, the researchers went crazy.
Dr. Kligman in Philadelphia increases a dosage 468 times, which actually frightened Dow Chemical. They couldn't believe that a respected doctor would do that. In Washington, D.C., you had Walter Freeman, who was a very, very well-known lobotomist who traveled around the country doing lobotomies in his car. And he would use an ice pick. He could do 15 to 20 in a day. It was just incredible what some doctors did, and very few, if any, people in the hospital or the medical community blew the whistle on it. It really was an egregious act, and it showed that the medical community was more interested in protecting its ass than in protecting the test subject and the patients, because a lot of doctors went off the deep end and started doing things that are just inconceivable now.
To express his indignation, Alan Hornblum wrote half a dozen books. A former prison guard at Holmesburg in Pennsylvania, from his first day at work over 40 years ago, he had a horrible shock.
I was stunned to see scores of inmates with their shirts off, strapped and wrapped in bandages and gauze tape. And I couldn't imagine that I was going into an atmosphere that was that violent, because all of the men looked like they had just walked a cell block knife fight.
They explain that it's not because of any violence, but experiments that are carried out there. Alan was the first to denounce this scandal and would lose his job as a result.
It was probably the largest human experimentation factory in America, possibly the world. From 51 until 1974, more people were probably incorporated in more experiments than any other place in the world.
Drugs, viruses, cancerous cells, plutonium, sarin gas, the most toxic products were tested in Holmesburg, but also in dozens of prisons throughout the country. To condemn these experiments, Alan Hornblum found former inmates like Youssef. In 1961, this man was imprisoned for selling marijuana. He was poor, with limited education. He was offered a chance to take part in tests for a dollar a day. Since then, Youssef has had his digestive tract operated on. He has liver and skin problems and can no longer work. His first test was for a bath foam from the company Johnson & Johnson.
They took tape and they stuck it on your back and pulled it off, stuck it on and pulled it off until the first layer of skin came off your back.
In
and they put six sections on my back like that. And then they took a bottle with the Johnson & Johnson bubble bath and put it on a patch and put the patch over the raw area. Then they took a can. I recognized that can as being from the Army. And I was like, what Johnson & Johnson got to do with this? So he took the can and he sprayed it on my back. And when it hit my back, it was cold. But it was so toxic and like fumes, I could taste it in my mouth. And as I'm walking down, I'm getting dizzier and dizzier, dizzier and dizzier. By the time I step into my cell, I passed out. Boom, and my back was inflamed. And by the time I woke up that morning, I had great big blisters on my back full of pus. This rash just gets worse and worse. And it looks like when the moon come out at night, it flames up. And I'll be moaning and crying. My cell partners couldn't sleep. We goes over there, a little shot cup, and it looked like water. We drinks it. Everything became magnified. The sound, like the loudspeaker on the system. Ooh, ooh, ooh. The walls looked like they turned into water. You know what I mean? And like I spent the whole time like looking around like this here instead of doing the test. So I goes back to the block in that condition. And man, I mean, I was tripping. And it was like a slow-acting drug that was in that cup. It lasts for weeks. The inmates start naming me Outer Limits. I had no conversation for nobody. I was scared of the inmates, and the inmates act like they was afraid of me.
What you had were hundreds and hundreds of uneducated minorities, overwhelmingly black and Puerto Rican, and then you had white doctors with white lab coats with PhD or MD after their name, and it was a recipe for abuse, if not disaster. And those prison walls are an ideal spot to do controversial experiments, because just as those walls keep the inmates in, they also keep the public out, so no one finds out about it.
Prisoners were used, but also patients. In certain hospitals, patients were steered towards the services financed by the CIA. These services carried out limitless experiments on psychological manipulation. In 1965, Karen Wetmore was only 13 when she was admitted to a hospital in Vermont. She stayed there several times in her childhood. She suffered from severe depression after falling victim to a pedophile neighbor. Admitted against her will, she was not allowed any contact with her family, being told that it was for her own good.
The CIA was specifically looking for children between the ages of 13 and 18 to further dissociate. They wanted dissociative children. Here's a sense of absolute and total helplessness. You're there, you're bound up, you're locked in this room. No matter how you scream, no matter what you say, no one is going to come. It does something to you, something you don't get over.
The doctors went to work on Karen. They wanted to erase her memory and create a robot at their command. It took 30 years of legal battles for Karen to obtain her medical records and discover the violence of the treatments she was subjected to.
It says seclusion, full cam. A cam is a straitjacket. And ties, which means they tied my arms and they tied my feet. This goes on uninterrupted, day after day, week after week, February, March, April, right up until June 21st, 1971, you sleep on the floor, no blanket, no nothing. And my arms were secured like this, behind my back. I do remember that. It's extremely painful because it pulls on your neck, pulls on your shoulder. You can't get away from it. It's maddening is what it is, maddening. And I was naked. And I think that was part of the effort
that experiment to break me down. Everything they did was to break me down.
Months in a confined room with no bearings, while her captors administered all kinds of drugs and sometimes electric shocks at inhuman levels.
Number of shocks and the seconds that they held the shocks. They had 30, 30, 35, 35, 35, and they held it for sustained for 40 seconds. A normal shock would be a second. Certainly not 30 and 35 of them. One, not that many, which probably is what obliterated my memory right there. And I think that's the way they did it. They also said, in this treatment right here, no seizure, shock restarted, so they gave me a second one. Because they couldn't produce a seizure. So they must have done it over again, must have repeated it. It's unforgivable. And I'm sure I wasn't the only one they did this to, I'm sure. I survived to be able to talk about it.
How many suffered similar experiments? In Montreal, Canada, the CIA used a world-renowned psychiatrist to set up a factory of guinea pigs in the Allen Memorial Psychiatric Department in McGill University. This psychiatrist was Ewan Cameron, one of the all-powerful presidents of the World Psychiatric Association. In 1945, Ewan Cameron made the acquaintance of Rudolf Hess, one of the Nazis accused in the Nuremberg trial. In 1957, the CIA recruited him for their MK-Ultra program. The Americans wanted to perfect their interrogation techniques and program a human to kill. Ewan Cameron became the mad dog of psychiatry. He put his patients in vegetative states for several weeks, while bombarding them with pre-recorded orders. Some would become incontinent, amnesiac, forgetting even who their parents were and how to speak. The Vermont hospital where Karen Wetmore was confined was working on the same program in the hands of the CIA doctors. She was like a rag doll.
They used drugs like LSD. They used electric shock. They used chemical shock agent metrazole, which I was given in 1971, and I found that out in my medical records, which is a very brutal drug, very brutal drug. CIA said it was excruciating physically and emotionally, excruciating drug. I have a quote from the CIA that said that the Soviets used it in the gulags, and that a POW would say or do anything to avoid a second dose. Nice drug.
There's all kinds of people who believe and people who don't believe, and that's a debate about do you believe or don't believe. I'm always interested in what are in the documents saying. So the documents clearly describe implanting electrodes in people's brains, activating the electrode from a remote transmitter, and changing the person's behavior from angry, pounding the wall, sitting there just staring.
Behind Karen's ear is a scar, and she doesn't know what it's from.
Once my therapist really understood that I had really been experimented on by the CIA, she said to me, you know, just for the heck of it, let me look. Because we'd read about, there's been information about these implants. And I'm like, okay. And it was there, actually there. I showed you. I went to a plastic surgeon who told me it was a surgical scar. But there's nothing in my medical history, nothing in a medical record that shows any kind of problem ever behind my right ear, or any incision or any surgery or anything else. But there it is.
What stopped the journey down this destructive path? In 1973, while Watergate is rattling all the institutions, Richard Helms, director of the CIA, feels the winds of change. He works as a lone wolf and hasn't informed the president of these experiments. He knows he's crossed the line. To protect himself, he orders the destruction of all documents relating to the MKUltra program and its abandonment. 2 years later, in 1975, the President Gerald Ford orders an inquiry into the CIA. The Rockefeller Commission is sworn in. The task isn't simple, because at the heart of the CIA, even Richard Helms' close lieutenants know nothing about the brainwashing programs.
There's a lot of goofy things go on in a big agency like that with all that secrecy. Things can go on that you don't know about, that the people who are working for the director most closely don't know about, or that the director doesn't know about. I mean, they're keeping it quiet down there. Don't tell anybody. If it works, then we'll tell them. But, you know, in the meantime, don't get into any difficulties. I remember when they wanted to take a kitty cat and stick a microphone up its rear end and put an antenna on its ear and have him walk in where we, if there's a spy in the park with another one, walk over and walk around and listen in on it. You know, they tried it one time in an experiment, and a taxi came by and ran over the cat, you know. So.
In reality, nothing is funny. In its haste to get rid of evidence, the CIA forgets 20,000 documents. A drop of water compared to the amount that was destroyed, but they reveal that it financed 149 programs, implicating 80 institutions, including the most respected. Called on to justify themselves, the heads of the CIA, like Dr. Lashbrook, lie and downplay the facts.
There was, of course, claims or thoughts that maybe great things could be done with hypnosis. One small project in which we had a hypnotist do some experiments, primarily to see what the limitations of hypnosis might be. Can you make a person do something under hypnosis that he would not ordinarily do?
Even if the head of the CIA, Richard Helms, tried to minimize the scale of the experiments, the victims' testimonies contradict him.
The next thing I remember,
the inquiry commissions follow, each reaching more and more witnesses, like this woman, Chris DeNicola. Her father put her in the hands of a reputed CIA doctor, Dr. Green, when she was 12 years old.
His objective was to gain control of my mind and train me to be a spy assassin. Dr. Green had electrodes on my body, including my head. He used what looked like an overhead projector and repeatedly said he was burning different images into my brain while a red light flashed aimed at my forehead. In between each sequence, he used electric shock on my body and told me to go deeper and deeper, while repeating each image would go deeper into my brain and I would do whatever he told me to do. Dr. Green moved on to wanting me to kill dolls that look like real children.
Inquiry reports that resulted from these terrifying testimonies revealed one thing for certain. The experiments ended in disaster. In its insane quest for a robot human or a truth serum, the CIA failed. On August 3, 1995, with the revelations mounting up, then-President Bill Clinton makes a public apology. Since then, a great number of secret archives have been released to the public domain. Researchers would take an interest in this troubled period, notably Hank Alberelli, who worked on the suspicious death of Frank Olson, the biochemist who worked at the heart of the CIA. Since 1951, the year of the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident, Frank Olson called into question the ethics of the experiments being carried out and became depressed as a result. In November 1953, the CIA put LSD into his glass without him knowing. 9 days later, he threw himself off the 13th floor of a New York hotel. Murder or suicide, we'll never know. At the time of the investigation, Hank Alberelli found a surprising document coming from the White House. It surprisingly linked the name of Frank Olson to Pont Saint-Esprit. Why, in the middle of the Korean War, would the White House be interested in this small French village? Even better, Hank also came across a study carried out by the CIA on LSD.
The document itself was a comprehensive overview or history, if you will, of LSD specifically, yes. Not on ergot. It had nothing to do with ergot. There was a section or a chapter, if you will, headed incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. And the first two paragraphs of that describe essentially what we've all read, you know, many times over in terms of what happened at Pont Saint-Esprit. But the remainder of that section, the rest of that page, which was about half the page, and the two pages that followed, were completely blacked out.
Above all was this damning document from the CIA. It dates from 1953 and has no doubt been declassified by mistake. A director at Sandoz Laboratories confirmed to a secret agent that the Pont Saint-Esprit incident was caused by LSD. Sandoz Laboratories was where Albert Hoffman worked, the man who discovered LSD. It even claimed the drug was responsible for the Pont Saint-Esprit tragedy before recanting. This same document states that in 1952, the source at the CIA had already explained that the cursed bread was caused by LSD. Did French authorities try to silence the affair? Several years after the drama, a head of the Victims Association was shocked at how disinterested the investigators were. Do the French have something to hide? We've interrogated former members of the Secret Services, investigated national and regional archives, as well as those from the police and the Justice Department. The files are hard to find, and many important pieces, such as reports from main hearings, have disappeared. If America revealed unwillingly some of its secrets about its participation in the poisoning, the uncertainties over the involvement of the French authorities may yet go on for some years longer. It takes 75 years for some sensitive documents to be made public. Hidden in its small streets and stone buildings, Le Pont Saint-Esprit drama has yet to reveal all its secrets.
Judging from the CIA's dark and notorious past of misconduct, perhaps it'll be no surprise if horrific clandestine high-tech experiments are being carried out somewhere in the world by the CIA at this very moment. Secrets that we must wait 75 years to be declassified, if ever disclosed to the public at all. And that's everyone for this week on Aperture. It's goodbye.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
This
for
is
a better life.
For a better life.
Farmud Boris to Lo'ot
يتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program of For a Better Life. I am Beta at your service. And in this episode again, we're going to talk about something really controversial and important for having a better life. Stay tuned with me. Anger or ghadab, which is one of the problems if you're facing nowadays in everyday life, in routine life. Every day you go out, you see people who are always angry, nagging, they are shouting at each other, fighting, and so on. This is a view that we can face often in the street and everywhere we go. And there is a lot to say about anger. So let me give you the hadith and the concepts that are really beautiful to hear and are lessons, precious lessons that we have to learn in our life. Those who spend, whether in prosperity or in adversity, restrain their anger and pardon men, and Allah loves those who do good. As you know, there is a strong emphasis on not being angry towards all the people and restrain your anger and forgive people. So this is a really important principle of Islam. Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, said, anger is the key that opens the door to all kinds of vices. It is narrated from Imam Sadiq, peace be upon him, that he heard his father Imam Baghir as saying, a Bedouin come to the Prophet and said, I live in the desert. Teach me the essence of wisdom. The Prophet said to him, I command you not to get angry. After repeating his question three times and hearing the same reply from the Prophet every time, he said to himself, after this, I will not ask any question, since the Apostle of God does not command anything but good. Imam Sadiq, peace be upon him, says, my father used to say, is there anything more violent than anger? Rarely a man gets angry and kills someone whose blood has been forbidden by God or slanders a married woman. So, we're going to talk about the reality of anger more after a short break. Stay tuned, dear listeners. IRIB English Radio. This is For a Better Life, and we are talking about anger or adab, which is one of the biggest sins that we can commit, and it's a key to open the door of other sins. We were actually supposed to talk about reality of anger. Anger is a psychological state that results from inner agitation and desire for revenge. And when this agitation becomes more violent, it intensifies the fire of anger. A violent commotion engulfs one's brain, on account of which the mind and the intellect lose control and become powerless. At that time, the inner state of a person resembles a cave where fire has broken out, filling it with flames and suffocating clouds of smoke, and so on. So when that happens, it becomes extremely difficult to pacify such a person and to extinguish the fire of his wrath. So whatever is thrown in it to cool it down becomes a part of it, adding to its intensity. It's for this reason that such a person becomes blind and deaf to guidance and good etiquettes. In such a condition, all such a force as counsel, advice, fail to appease the person. The more one tries to pacify it through a humble request and a force, the more violent it becomes, until the angry person physically harms someone or seeks revenge. Imam Baghir said, indeed, this anger is a spark lit by Satan in the heart of the son of Adam. So, there are some consequences and effects of anger. A person given to anger behaves unreasonably like a lunatic without rationality considering the outcome of his actions. He commits ugly and indecent acts, and his tongue, limbs, and body go out of his control. Anger may lead one to use abusive language against the prophets of God and his awliya.
As to the moral hazards, anger may cause malice towards creatures of God, leading sometimes even to the enmity not only of the prophets and awliya, but also of the holy essence of God. So anger is like a fire that is burning, and there are many factors that can make this fire stronger and stronger to the point that you lose your control. And this is why anger can be the key to some biggest sins in the world, because you lose your control. So the similitude of anger in this world is the fire of divine wrath in the hereafter. In the same way that anger emanates from the heart, perhaps spiritual reality of this anger is a fire of divine wrath that also emanates from the inner depth of the heart and spread over the external being, and whose actually tormenting flames emerge from external organs such as the eyes, the ears, and the tongue. And as you see, always there is this similarity between anger and fire. And first place, we got to know that anger can be really detrimental and harmful because it's like fire. You cannot control it, and after trying to control it, maybe it's so strong that it will make you lose control. But next step, we're going to talk about the advice to cure anger. There should be some ways to cure this angry behavior that some people have. But let's keep it here, go for a short break, then we're gonna come back.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
For a better life, we are here again talking about hints and points that can help us to have a better life. As you know, we live once, only one chance to live in this world. So we have to seize the moment, we have to learn more and more and more from the cradle to the grave. We're talking about this concept of anger, but now we're going to advise some cure for actually healing this angry behavior of some people. A person with a habit of often getting angry should know that anger is the faculty that is granted by God Almighty for the sake of the preservation, continuity, and survival of human species, and for the discipline and order of the family system, and protection of human rights and safeguarding divine laws. This is a really beautiful perspective on anger. So anger actually is a blessing, you know. It turns to a sin when you are using, or just let's correct it, abusing it in a way that will hurt other people, that will hurt yourself, and that will burn you in its fires and flames. If he acts contrary to these divine purposes and makes use of power of anger against the design of God, it will be a breach of trust that deserves severe punishment from him. So, what an act of ignorance and injustice it is not to live up to divine trust and to incur his wrath. He should therefore seriously think about the moral vices and vicious deeds that are the outcomes of anger, and try to remove their evil effects, each one of which is capable of afflicting a person till eternity, causing many problems in this world, as well as punishment in the hereafter. Just so, only thinking about the fact that this anger will make the wrath for you in the afterlife and will actually be a kind of betrayal to the trust of Allah should be enough for you, should be enough reason for you to stop this angry behavior. And I just want to end it here. Thank you for listening to us. I wish you have a peaceful life full of love of Allah, which is the most important, actually, source of love, peace, and beauty. Thank you for listening to me. It was all the time we had for today's episode. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, he knows. Oh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.